This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarterbin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I will select sort of at random. Any book from my comic book collection is eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 150th episode of the Quarterbin, we're looking at Defenders 99 from Marvel Comics, cover dated September 1981. And spoilers, I won't be alone when I start talking about that issue. But first, a little feedback. The first thing I posted on Twitter last time was that the feed had a problem. If you downloaded the episode right when it came out in that first hour or two, instead of hearing me talk about Marvel Magazine number 5, what you got was me talking about Marvel Magazine number 4, and then you got a time travel headache. So I posted that the feed had an issue and that I was going to fix it. And some of our Twitter friends believed that that was a good reason to make some terrible, terrible puns. Yeah, I'm looking at you, Dr. Ange. Luke, you have no excuse. Robert, come on, man. You're better than that. But that little problem actually did allow me to have a nice chat with Herman, Clinton, and Rob Myers about the importance of podcasters subscribing to their own shows to listen and learn quickly if there are any problems or issues with the feed or with the episode. Patrick Delmore from the Star Trek podcast Next Generation's First Generation gave that episode a hooray when it appeared and called it the one I've been waiting for. And then after listening, Patrick said he really enjoyed the episode. Since Steve and Andy won't be covering this Doom adventure, I'm glad I got to hear it from you. Love the descriptions of Reed, particularly, quote, "That's when the party starts." Thank you, Patrick. Yes, I was pretty proud of that line. Luke Giaconetti said he's always hyped up for coverage of the magazines. Podcasting's Michael Bailey replied within a day of the episode, continuing to live up to his New Year's resolution. Professor, I wholeheartedly agree with you on this being an excellent reprint book. That FF story is amazing, despite Big Comics' obvious interference in the ending. Welcome to the awakening, Michael. The Hulk story was great as well, he continues. That issue was one of the first, if not the first, to acknowledge the fact that the Hulk was gray in the first issue. Just about every reprint of that issue recolored the Hulk as green, but here Byrne does some of his patented continuity stuff and uses the different art take on Hulk as a story point. This was a great run of Hulk comics. It would have been interesting to see where he went from here, but then we wouldn't have gotten Peter David on the book. And that Thing story is a classic, even if it's light on plot. This wouldn't be the last time they would visit Reed thinking about Ben's appearance, though Big Comic got involved in the next one because Reed claims that all of this attempt to cure Ben didn't work because of Ben. This is obviously Reed trying to cover up his incompetence, but will anyone say this? No. Why? Big Comic. Open your eyes, sheeple. I mean, obviously not you, Professor. You're on the right track. Keep up the great work. Podcasting's Michael Bailey. Look, it's time for some real talk here. Sometimes, Michael and I express opinions about minor things like current events and world news and political leadership and stuff like that, and we're not totally in agreement on those all the time. But on important things, like Dr. Doom and Big Comic and Stretchy McButtface, we are in 100% complete and total lockstep. Open your eyes, sheeple. And thank you, Podcasting's Michael Bailey, for those wise and well-considered thoughts. Jason C. tweeted out, "Thanks to Professor Allen for keeping me pleasant virtual company in the dentist chair today as I stoically, manfully endure a drill and fill. I'm not sure that they use laughing gas anymore for dental procedures, but that would explain many of Jason's kind and effusive words here. No, seriously. Thank you, and I hope your teeth are doing well." Mike Zomkowski pointed out the obvious, saying that the presence of doom in this issue and episode makes both winners. And then he asked a very pointed question. "I'm a big fan of your old Doom 2099 episodes. Any chance of more of those in the future?" Well, there are some more in the database, and I haven't decided if I'm going to continue with the number 9 special episodes, or certainly haven't decided what they will be. But looking ahead, I think it's probably more likely that those, which is to say the Doom 2099 issues, would show up eventually on the Doomspeak podcast. Because at some point, because of hashtag Big Comic not allowing Doom's gloriousness to continue forever, that ongoing is going to fade away at some point. And when that happens, maybe I'll continue to use that forum to talk about Doom-centric stories. And if that happens, picking up with Doom 2099 is not a bad suggestion. So maybe at that point, no promises, I'm just talking here. But thanks, Mike, for getting me thinking in those directions. So maybe at that point, that show could be, you know, turned into a show that covers of other Doomtastic comic issues. I don't know, but for what it's worth, this many months away or maybe a year away from that happening, that's kind of the way I'm leaning. So that was a great question, Mike Zomkowski. Sad that I do not have an appropriately great answer. Social media love for that last episode came from Sir Martin of Grey, from the blog Too Dangerous for a Girl, Wonder Woman, Warrior for Peace, Clinton from Coffee and Comics, Safwan94, Billy D from Magazines and Monsters and Into the Weird, Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, Sir Iowa's Joe Crawford, Sir Luke of the Upstate, Gene Hendricks from that episode of Back to the Bins that I was on recently, Karen from Between the Pages, Mike from Comics in the Golden Age, and our lovely and kind listeners of the year, Darren and Ruth of the Sutherlands. All right, it's about time to take a break, play a promo, and when we come back, me and a guest will be talking all about Defenders 99.
Welcome to the world of tomorrow!
The Legion of Superheroes through the Silver Age, the Bronze Age, the Baxter series, 5 years later, the reboot, the three-boot, the retro-boot, the animated series. We have banded together as the Legion of Super Bloggers to cover it all. Seek us out at legionofsuperbloggers.blogspot.com.
And we're back. And if you're a longtime fan of this podcast, I mean, not just a listener, but a fan, you know what it means that this is episode 150. Because ever since number 50, every 25 episodes, we've been visited by a consistent pest. Guest. It's guest.
Now, Ghost of Christmas Pest.
Now, you know, sometimes on these episodes, we've had lots of guests. But whether he's solo or part of a small group or part of a big pack of people, this man has been here for episodes 50, 75, 100, 125, and now 150. So welcome back, regular,
Quarterbin special guest, Mr. Paul Spatero.
Thank you once again for having me. Every 25 episodes on the Quarterbin, I think it's fitting.
See, that's perfect. Perfect. You know, I've been reposting older episodes because, you know, the way our feed has worked, they've fallen off the main feed. So I've set up Quarterbin Classics. And when I got to number 25, I thought about if I can just take a couple of your clips, I can, you know, deep fake that you were actually there at number 25 also.
It's a darn shame.
My production skills are not at that level, so we just had to let that one go. We started this tradition at number 50, which is a classic episode, by the way.
I did have an episode where Bill was not available, and I had him record a couple of sound clips beforehand, and I just kind of spliced them in to make it seem like he was there. And I think some people actually bought it.
Perfect. Well, with Bill, you know.
You could just believe he fell asleep.
and didn't bring a book, so it works perfectly. Let me ask you this question about the Dynamic Defenders, because I know you are my Marvel Bronze Age dude. Mm-hmm. So where do the Defenders sort of rank among your Marvel teams? Just to, you know, give you a few. You got the Avengers and the FF, Guardians of the Galaxy. All of those teams that start with the letter X.
America, that's a of lot course. Of teams.
Team America. I mean, where do the Defenders fit for you?
I'm thinking they're number 3. Behind team, the Avengers and the Fantastic
team,
Four.
And Team America?
Team America is, it's almost, they're almost tied with them, but somehow Team America falls back about 7 or 8 more teams.
And is there either a run or an era of the team or just a favorite lineup of the team?
Well, lineup-wise, I go with the classic team, and that would be the Hulk, Doctor Strange, Submariner, then slight offshoot, we bring in the Silver Surfer, Nighthawk, and Valkyrie.
Okay.
After that, everybody else is superfluous, but that group of, what is that, six people, they are the core as far as I'm concerned.
Gotcha. And we had most of them in this issue to one extent or another.
Yeah, they all appear.
Appear, yes.
Nighthawk is kind of a shell of himself in this one, but he is in there. And, you know, as far as eras go, the first issue I purchased was issue 13, where they fought the Squadron Sinister.
Oh.
And I really was hooked immediately on this team. Over the years, you know, my collection ebbed and waned and grew. And only within the last year did I reclaim the full complete run.
Ah, nice.
Which would be the 3 issues that were in Marvel Feature. And then, you know, from there, Defenders number 1 through, I don't recall what it went up to, like 150-something.
And how many with those were for a quarter?
Quite a few, actually.
Oh, good. That's it. That's what we like to hear.
Some of them were for a quarter because that was the cover price.
Perfect.
But yeah, the most recent, the last issue I needed to finish the collection was issue 10. Which was pretty elusive because it's part of the Avengers Defenders War, and it's one where the Hulk fights Thor. So it was kind of a, you know, I kept seeing it on the walls in comic shops for, you know, $40, and I was not willing to spend that kind of money. But I think I did eventually have to suck it up a little bit, and I bought it last year. I think I spent $12.
I'll assume when there was the Skype connection just went bad because I thought you said $12. That sounds too much. That sounds too much. I don't know.
After I had been searching for it for quite a while, and yeah. Even that took a little sucking it up to say, okay, I'm willing to spend that. I'm trying to remember, but I think I purchased issue number 1 not all that long ago for like $5.
Nice. Okay. That's acceptable.
In, you know, halfway decent shape. It's not, you know, certainly not mint, but it's not whipped either.
What is it generally you like about this team?
I think it's, you know, I mean, you talk about the non-team structure, right, that they, right, you know, they don't have a formal team. But it's less that, and it's more the just weird combination of heroes that they put together.
Right.
You know, Doctor Strange, to me, never seemed like a team player. He always seemed like somebody who really should be on his own. And to kind of make him the leader of the team, it was putting a round peg into a square hole. Kind of the same thing with the Submariner, not really a team player. He's always talking about how, you know, he didn't want to be there.
Hulk, and eventually, of course, they,
yeah, the Hulk. Well, the Hulk just had, you know, appeal on many levels. And yeah. Silver Surfer was always a favorite. And in my early days of collecting, he was used sparingly in Marvel because I think Stan kind of kept a close
cornered the market on that. Yeah.
So, you know, it was definitely a strange combination of characters. You know, eventually they kind of got around to making the Submariner an Avenger, making Doctor Strange an Avenger, and then after it proved so popular in the movies, they had to bring the Hulk back into the Avengers. And it's one of the things I'm not so crazy about the Avengers is now, I love that team, but it's now if you look at the Marvel Universe, it's like, well, everybody's been an Avenger at some point. There's nothing unique about it.
Right. It's kind of almost like they're the major leagues. You can be on the Defenders, but you know you've really made it when you get called up to the Avengers or something like that. You know, it sort of has that that feel to it. I would imagine if you're a fan of the Defenders, like, hey, come on.
And I did really enjoy, there was a subsequent series, I think it was Eric Larson's, where Yandroth, who's kind of was a big part in them forming the group in the first place, he put some sort of spell on them or something where despite the fact that they all hated each other, they were bound together somehow and they had to be a team. I really love the dynamic of all of that.
But enough about my family reunion. Let's talk about comic book, okay?
it's throughout the run, it's been a lot of fun. It did start to, you know, I think when they get away from the core group, it loses a little some of its appeal.
Right.
And they always seem to have to bring back that core group when they drift too far from it. And the book you have here tonight is kind of, it's got the core group in it, but they're not really, you know, the team anymore. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's kind of getting the band back together a little bit. But like I said, I think they saw, you know, if you look even at this book on the cover at the upper corner, it's got pictures of Doctor Strange, Valkyrie, Hellcat, and the Son of Satan. Doesn't even have Hulk, Submariner, Nighthawk, or Silver Surfer.
Well, the issue that I'm looking at doesn't have a top corner.
Oh,
so well, let's talk about this, and I guess we can start there because Defenders 99 had a cover price of, well, again, you'll have to fill me in. I'm guessing 50 cents based
correct
on the subscription price on the inside front cover. The mine doesn't actually say 50 cents.
Yes, it is, okay. 50 cents.
Okay, good.
double the intended price.
Or 50% discount. That's the way we think about it. So, but that is one of the nice things about being almost exclusively a comic book reader and not so much a collector, not worrying about condition or a partially missing cover, because I mean, that's the only way that I've been able to find, you know, regularly find Bronze Age books for really cheap. Is to find them in some, let's say, less than perfect condition.
I'm willing to take less than perfect into my collection, and we were kind of talking about this before we started recording, but when the cover starts to be missing, I kind of draw the line on that, with the exception of, as we were talking about, I have I think it's Spider-Man number 27, where it's missing the top third of the cover, and to replace that with the actual full cover issue would probably be cost prohibitive. Mm-hmm. So I allow that one to stay in my collection.
Oh, I respect the way you think on that. Perfect financial logic on that one. What we have here is an Al Milgram cover. We've got Doc Strange and the Surfer, a lot of these folks you mentioned, Namor, the Hulk, and others, battling before the throne of Mephisto, who is saying, "This is it, Defenders, the final conflict." So what do you think?
It's a little bit of an atypical cover because three of our six heroes have their back to the reader. Mm-hmm. And no one is looking at the reader except for Mephisto. So it's a little different. I do like the layout, but I've never been a huge fan of Al Milgram's final work. I always felt it just lacked a certain dynamism. So I think it's, like I said, I think it's a really solid layout. But if I picture this same scenario, only rendered by, you know, an artist that I am more enamored with, you know, say Jack Kirby or John Romita or Neil Adams.
I think it would be being more action-packed, much more dynamic.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's dramatic. It sets the tone. And I guess if you've been following the story up to this point, you can see that it's heading to a conclusion, or at least as much as a comic book ever reaches a conclusion.
Well, they're setting themselves up for the big 100th anniversary.
100, exactly. So this is The Final Conflict with a question mark, is the actual title of the story. I'm going to say, as you just spoiled us, not really. Prelude to The Final Conflict is probably what this is. This is written by Jam DeMatteis, with art by Don Perlin and Joe Sinnott. And we start with a one-page recap of what's gone on before. Last issue, Doctor Strange receives an emergency call from the Avengers concerning activities in Citrusville, Florida, a town which vanished overnight, leaving a crater behind in the shape of a six-fingered hand. Now, at some point, we have to make the joke. We might as well do it here, Paul. You're used to working. Scott Gardner and Dr. Bill, a couple proud Floridians. So you're used to concerning activities from places like Citrusville. I mean, this just seems like a regular weekend for Scott. I'm just saying.
Scott and his six-fingered hand?
I hear rumors. That's all I'm saying. So they headed to the Nexus of All Realities. That didn't work out so good. And the team, minus Hellcat, ended up floating between worlds, and they end up at the start of this issue, captured by Maya, the chairman of the six-fingered hand. And I'm glad that the six-fingered hand has a legal corporate structure, evidently with shareholders that have elected a board and nominated Mr. Maya to be the chairman. Okay, so not only have they been captured, this is Doc Strange and Valkyrie and Gargoyle and Damon Hellstrom, but some of their buddies like Clea and the Silver Surfer, the Hulk, Submariner, some pretty heavy hitters have been nabbed here. The Son of Satan tries lashing out with his trident, calling Maya a smug, vile-hearted animal. The attack has no effect, and Doctor Strange suggests they try a more diplomatic approach. Strange learns from Clea that the hand tricked her into thinking he was in trouble, and summoned the others, and they were all defeated and captured. But Strange, who can bear it no longer, tries to free them with his magic, but quickly learns that the energy spheres that they're encased in are linked to their life forces, which means freeing them will pretty much kill them. Hellstrom chides the Doctor for so quickly abandoning negotiation, which 2 pages before he was all in favor of. The six-fingered hand offers to show them around their refurbished version of Citrusville to give them an idea of how they intend to redesign the entire Earth. Gargoyle stays behind when the demons mock his uselessness and that he betrayed them to the Defenders. This mockery causes Valkyrie to give out a good, swift kick, but Maya stops any further conflict. We jump back to Earth, and we see Kyle Richmond, Nighthawk, attended to by his private nurse. He's then visited by Hellcat, who teleports into the room with a stolen shadow cloak and offers to help cure his immobility issues, and then whisks him away. While at the ruins of Patsy's New Jersey home, another shadow cloak had been identified there, but demons are all over that place. Back at the Nexus, I guess, the Defenders are horrified that Citrusville has been transformed into a hellish version of itself and its people transformed into faceless creatures. Son of Satan attacks, and Maya unleashes an army of demons in response. Citrusville residents that rally, arming themselves with chains and clubs and axes, because Florida. Our heroes are overwhelmed, but a few of the natives do end up returning to human form. Gargoyle and Clea and the Surfer, Hulk, Submariner arrive. And as you would hope, this does turn the tide of the battle. They destroy the demons, and the defenders are surprised when the people of Citrusville fade away or teleported or something. This is madness, Doctor Strange says. And then the demons begin to lose their powers and shrink in size until they vanish from sight. Gargoyle explains that he freed the others with his powers and allowed him to absorb and redirect life force energies around. And they notice that Maya, the leader of the six-figured hand, is still among them, and he reveals his true identity. Mephisto, Lord of the Netherworld. Back on Earth, Hellcat and Kyle arrive in Arizona. She takes Nighthawk through a tunnel into hell, and they end up before the throne of Damien Hellstrom's father, a.k.a. Satan. Shimmering dimensions away, Mephisto captures the defenders and giant cylinders, explains their entire plot. After the near destruction of Eternity, he and his comrades orchestrated the Six-Fingered Hand conspiracy to prompt Doctor Strange to constantly use his transportation spell, which weakened the fabric of reality and allowed them to carry out their evil plan. They eventually arrive in what appears to be New York City, but it's been turned into a blazing inferno. Welcome to hell on Earth. To be continued. And first of all, what I love about the Bronze Age applies to Marvel and DC. So much happens in this issue. This is just crazy busy. I mean that in a good way.
You know, we've talked on Back to the Bin so many times about how the decompressed stories leave us a little cold. When you pick up a book and 10 minutes later you've done reading it, and that's only because you took your time going through it. Especially, you know, when you compare that to the increase in price. And it's not only the increase in price for a new book, it's the increase in price over the book in general, because you could still buy most of those older books for less than it cost you to buy a new one.
Mm-hmm. And they take longer to read. They're much meatier. Much more happens.
They do lose, I guess, a little bit of the sense of realism. I think the decompressed stories tend to have a little bit more in the way of emotions and events that occur and, you know, bridge the gap between one thing and another. So I guess they do tend more towards realism. But I never at any point said that I read comics for realism. So I'm fine with the lack of realism in these. And, you know, as long as I guess, you know, my rule for science fiction is set your, you know, the rules for your universe and follow them. Mm-hmm. You know, I just don't like when they create the rules and then they break them on their own. But other than that, you can be as outlandish as you want, pretty much.
Yeah. This story does qualify as outlandish.
It qualifies as outlandish from the perspective of demons and Satan are manipulating things to have all this happen, which, yes, it's not something we deal with in everyday life, but I think it's something we fear in everyday life.
Yeah. I like the horror-tinged aspects of this. And I like, it has those sci-fi elements, a little horror elements, a little superhero. It's sort of a little bit of everything.
One of the interesting things about it is, I guess, it's trying to set up the relationship between Mephisto and Satan. And I've never totally gotten a grasp on if they are separate but equal, or if they're different faces of the same entity.
I remember when I did a Ghost Rider issue recently that recounted a version of his origin. And I remember in sort of reading about that's been retconned more than once. Is Satan? No way, it's just Mephisto. You know, the idea that those are different, it was just a demon, but no, it was Satan. No, it was. So they, and I don't know if every writer or every era has a different version of that, or it's certainly not a consistent view of how those spiritualish, demonic characters all work together or don't work together. But you know, how those jigsaw puzzle pieces fit is never really clear.
Well, I think they don't want to ever say this is the definitive devil or this is the definitive divine god.
But you do get occasional places like this one where they're saying it's Satan.
But are they really, though, when you have Satan and Mephisto in the same book? Unless I'm mistaken, Satan and Mephisto are two different names for the same thing. So if you have them and you're presenting them as two separate entities in the book, like I said, once again, are they separate but equal? Are they two different faces for the same evil being? I really don't know, and I don't know that they want to tell us that.
To think too hard about that or give us a certain 100% answer to that. But we do know that Damien Hellstrom is the son of Satan.
Yes.
Does that make him also?
That's his name.
That's true. So is he son of Mephisto? It gets a little confusing, but I enjoyed that.
What do you think of the artwork in this book?
I don't have a lot of experience, or at least not much recollection of having strong feelings for Don Perlin and Joe Sinnott, but I thought the art it got the job done. I think it had some of that eeriness and weirdness. I thought that the scary faceless residents of Citrusville, that they were creepy. I think that look always creeps me out, and it's certainly designed to, the faceless face.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that. It's okay.
I think I get varying degrees of, I don't want to use the word enjoyment, varying degrees of interest in the demons and the way they're drawn. Some of them seem kind of creative and interesting, mm-hmm. and others seem very, very unimaginative.
Right.
The scene in the house in New Jersey when they walk in and there's all the mm-hmm. demons there, I think that page in particular is kind of very interesting to look at. And each demon drawn in there just draws my interest that I start looking to see, what the makeup is and why, what they're accomplishing with them. But then there's other scenes where there's a bunch of them together. Let's say the bottom of page 11, where they all look kind of generic to me.
Right. I do like sort of the flat top, sort of lady demon with sort of a triangular head.
She's got a party dress on.
Woohoo! She's in Florida.
She's happening.
So it's party time.
Now, Joe Sinnott, most of his work was on the Fantastic Four. With Jack Kirby, and then with Rich Buckler and several other people, George Perez. I've always found him to be a very clean inker. He doesn't overpower the style of whoever he's inking, but he usually cleans it up and makes it look better. I remember as a kid when I was reading the credits, and once in a while, instead of inker, they'd use the term embellisher.
Right.
And I always feel like that was a good term for what Joe Sinnott does. Mm. Whereas there's other inkers who overpower the art with their own style. As much as I do like some of the work he's done, Klaus Janson would be somebody who I would say that about. And then you have other guys like Vinnie Coletta, who, while a very good artist in his own right, would kind of rush through things and not necessarily improve what he was working on, and sometimes actually... Yeah. Take away from it.
Like literally take away
from it. Yeah, literally erase things.
Literally erase, yeah.
Erase details for the sake of getting it done quickly. So, inking is something that I've always kind of had a little bit of an eye for, but since I've been working on the podcast, I think working is a very loosely used term, but since I've been on the podcast and I'm reviewing books for what it's worth, I've always try to have more of an eye towards what is the inker doing, what is the penciler doing.
Right. About the most I can get out of that is the layout. The layout and the storytelling. I feel like I've got a good handle on that side of the art. But in mm-hmm. terms of the embellishing and I can't tell what, unless a background is really bad or really detailed, my eye for art has not developed. In my years.
Well, I know you're a story first comic mm-hmm. reader. I know that about you. I'm kind of 50-50. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because I'll, do some with you where you're story first. I'll do some with Scott where Scott is art first.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's kind of an interesting contrast sometimes. But, you know, in this instance, knowing what Joe Sinnott does in the way of inking and then looking at the final product here, it makes me say that Don Perlin kind of rendered, you know, like I used the word again that I used earlier, almost an unimaginative rendition of things. And that's not to say it's always bad. That last page, the Hell on Earth page, I think that looks terrific. The only one who doesn't look really good in there is Nighthawk, and I think that may be intentional because he's supposed to be recovering from whatever it was that was going on with him. So I think they wanted to make him look just a little bit more feeble. But I particularly like the demon who's standing guard just behind Satan with his arms crossed.
Mm-hmm.
And the demon's on the floor, and there's a head sticking up out of the ground.
Right.
There's just a lot of stuff. There's a tentacle coming up, yes, out of a sewer. There's a lot of things going on in this page. And then the background, there's even more stuff going on. That page is, I think that page is great. The page before it, where they're traveling in the cylinder, they all look terrific. Mm-hmm. It's more or less the battle scenes that I feel like look unimaginative. And some of the individual faces, when they're dealing with the human population and they come out of it, boy, that looks like J. Jonah Jameson in the bottom middle panel. So to me, the artwork in this book kind of goes from really lackluster, not bad, but lackluster, right, to really good. Mm-hmm. Story-wise, I think we have like a very complex storyline that's going on here, and we kind of jumped in the middle of it. Right. You know, a lot has happened before we got here, and we still have to get a conclusion. The whole idea of the six-fingered hand is kind of just an interesting thing, except on the bottom of the splash page where there's the six-fingered hand drawn beckoning the reader.
Yeah.
Kind of looks a little silly there.
In that sense, that's a perspective that we don't usually see. I do like it as the crater.
It's an interesting thought also, you know, that they set up a trap that Doctor Strange, every time he used his magic in certain ways, it would just further their cause. So by doing good, he's doing bad.
Mm-hmm. And I like that. They reference back to, I think, to at least issue 92 or 93. And so I don't know if the storyline has been going on that long, or at least these things in the background have been going on for a while. So you've been building, perhaps directly, perhaps also indirectly, towards this 99 and obviously the coming 100 showdown.
Honestly, I think it's been building very steadily at this point. It's been a while since I read this run, so you have to forgive me for not knowing each of the things. But I think, you know, from the point when they introduced the Gargoyle, who is not a major player in the story but has a role, and I'm just clicking on his page now to see when he was introduced, because I think that tells us when this storyline started, because his being converted into the Gargoyle is consistent with what was going on with these other demonic beings. I'm on the Marvel Wiki page for him. First appearance, Defenders 94.
There you go. Okay.
So at this point, we're six issues in to his run in this storyline. And there may have been some things going on in the background even before that I don't recall.
I'm interested in knowing what happens next. So that's always a fundamental determinant of success.
Yeah. It's, you know, is it a hook? Mm-hmm. You know, when you walk away, do you really want to continue to watch it, to read it? You know, if you were buying this comic new off the stand, would you get the next issue? I guess, right, is really what it comes down to. And I would say the answer to that is absolutely. Not only can I say it from a hypothetical point of view, but I could say it from reality because I bought it at the time.
I mean, this did seem like, you know, the perfect issue for you. I mean, again, it's probably better to be a back to the bins issue because we said we got Florida and we got New York. Both being destroyed and in flames. I mean, come on. Perfect for you guys. I feel bad that I poached it.
Yeah. You don't see Ohio too much in the comics.
Yep.
They don't visit your hometown very much.
Flyover country, you know. No respect. You know what's coming. No letter grades. No gold press latinum. our grading system here is very simple. We just think of it as pass-fail.
From the pass-fail perspective for the Quarter Bin podcast, mm-hmm. I purchased this book when new at 50 cents.
Oh, my Lance.
And I had no regrets.
Agreed. I mean, it was dramatic. And I like that horror-tinged superhero drama. I feel like I've read a lot of superhero stories. So I like when they can do something different. Throw a little horror, throw a little sci-fi, throw a little fantasy, throw a little crime, noir, I mean, whatever it is. I'm at the point where I like maybe just a little different take sometimes. And for me, this definitely qualifies as a different take.
I've always kind of liked the horror-based superhero books. But I find as I'm getting older, I appreciate them even more. Books like Tomb of Dracula, Werewolf by Night, The Living Mummy, Son of Satan, Ghost Rider, even to a lesser extent, Man-Thing. But for the most part, I've always enjoyed those books. And as I said, I actually enjoy them more now than I did even then. And I have been in the last couple of years seeking to fill the holes in my collection in those series. Some of which were really lacking. I really didn't have all that many issues of Werewolf by Night or Tomb of Dracula, and I've been picking them up recently and, you know, filling a lot of spots in my collection with those.
I've read probably a dozen Ghost Rider stories from various sort of different iterations and, you know, just random, you know, happenstance. And I've kind of enjoyed all this sort of various different takes on it. I think that's a character I could probably get into.
The other thing, I mean, it's far from the horror, but the other thing that I've developed a later appreciation for is Master of Kung Fu.
Yeah, I read a bunch of those 2-3 years ago, maybe 20 or 25 of them. You sort of spread throughout the last 50 issues or so of that run. That was surprisingly good.
I've been little by little picking some of them up, and now I'm just looking on the app on my phone. I have 33 issues of it now.
Nice.
You know, I'm going to slowly work my way towards filling in the gaps in that one. But that's one where it's very varied as far as the prices you see.
Yeah.
And I know you and I have discussed this, and you've given me not so much your tacit approval, but you've turned a blind eye to the fact that I said I will spend $1 and $2 on some books from the Bronze Age.
I just assume that is your New York cost of living. Compared to us, flyover country.
So pretty much
$1.50, $2, that is a quarter.
Now it is. But when I find the books in that range, I usually pick up the ones that fit into the holes in my collection. But I do find that they vary dramatically. You know, I'll find them for $1 or $2. I'll go to a comic show, and I'll find them in the dollar bins, and I'll get a few issues of it. And then walking around, I'll look, and there's another, you know, retailer, and they'll have the same issues for $5 or $6 each. So it really is a matter of being a discerning buyer.
Mm-hmm. We call it cheap. I mean, discern. I like discerning. I'm going to start using that.
Yes, it is cheap. I'm not going to try and justify it. But there's a sense of satisfaction,
yes,
when you are able to fill out, you know, at least large portions of the runs without ever having to spend top dollar on anything.
That's,
you know, there's an element of the hunt.
Yes.
And hunting down the issues at a reasonable price. Anybody can go onto eBay and pay top dollar for books.
Right.
Anybody who has the top dollar, actually.
Yeah.
You know, if you're willing to spend the dollar amount, you can find any book you want. But if you decide, okay, well, I'm going to buy these, but I don't want to break the budget for it.
Right.
Then there's a sense of satisfaction every time you go to a show and you find them for, you know, what you deem to be a reasonable price, and you come home with a stack of them. You feel, I don't know, I feel very good about it when I do that.
And that is why you're welcome here anytime, Paul. And by anytime, I mean every 25 episodes. Anytime an episode is divisible by 25. Anytime.
Anytime, welcome. 24 issues from now, episodes from now.
Well, we agree that this book is worth a quarter, and that will wrap up our coverage of Defenders 99, bringing episode 150 of the Quarter Bin podcast to a close. So, Paul, thank you again for joining us on this one. Appreciate it, as always.
Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure. And I look forward to episode 175.
So tell us some of those shows that you do over on the Two True Freaks Network are.
Okay, well, I do three shows, one of which we've made mention of on several occasions already, and that's Back to the Bins.
My favorite show. Where we review old comics.
Oh, and if you listened to the most recent episode, while we were recording it, I saw that you said that, and we were very, very appreciative of that thought. I actually had to edit it out because we almost became too effusive.
You can't have that. I understand.
Well, otherwise you're going to just think that we appreciate it too much. No. But anyway, the other two shows I do are Listen to the Prophets, in which we've gone from episode one of Deep Space Nine and worked our way through and are currently in the seventh and final season of that series. And the other show I do is It Jaws, where I and a rotating panel of guest hosts review movies old and new. You haven't been on in a while, so we'll have to work on that.
It's been a while. So thank you again, Paul. So now next time...
That's Andy Leyland's job, but I can jump in for him. Next time on an all-new episode.
Without Mr. Paul. We'll be starting a new mini-series of sorts, but I'll explain that all next time. But what we will be covering is Archie 101 from Archie Comics, of course, cover dated June 1959. And more importantly, as we've said, in episode 175, Paul will be back here to talk about something.
And I will either be back by myself or with someone.
Exactly. If you have any questions or comments about this issue or the episode or the Defenders or the podcast or how Paul keeps showing up on the show, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and he's Paul Spatero.
And the listeners are probably wondering what I have photos of you doing.
I know. Let's not even. I got tenure at the university. That's all that counts. They didn't come out during that process. That's all that matters. But until next time, I'll see you in the quarter bin.
The Quarterbin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.
What's up?
What is up, my homie?
You know, I don't know if you've done this to Em at all, but with my daughter, when she was younger, when her friends were around, I would purposely talk that way to make myself even more stiff than I would normally be. Not that I would be anything close to street anyway. And it would like totally, totally embarrass her.
That is, I was going to say that's half the fun of being a parent, but it's at least two thirds.
Yeah, it really is. Because anytime you can embarrass them, there's something positive to be said for that.
We just, you know, with budget crunches and all of that, we just had the early retirement options that were floated.
Mm-hmm. Right.
A little too early for me, but if they'd run it again in about 5 years, I would probably
That's the thing. It's like,
one good thing about having M around is that I made a deal for this weekend, because I'm going to be out in North Carolina visiting my dad, but the comic book store anniversary sale is this weekend, including the dollar books at 10 cents.
Oh, wow.
So I gave him a 5 spot. I said, you know, pick me up 25 or 30, and you can keep the change. It's worth a couple of bucks. Come on.
Now, that's dollar books for a dime. That's great.
So we'll see what M's eye picks me up. Can't beat that one. I was like, "Oh, how are you doing at the week? I'm not week. I'm gonna be gone."
You know, my only issue would be that in those dollar bins is a lot of like '90s and 2000s books that I would have no interest in anyway.
Yeah, you're gonna have some. Hopefully, if it's their sort of normal stock, you're gonna have some from this era, just in pretty bad condition, which is fine with me.
Depends
Bronze Age falling apart books. I don't mind reading those.
falling apart, I can live with. No cover, you know. I mean, I don't get me wrong. I enjoyed that issue of Marvel Tales you sent me, but it's not. It's never going to get bagged and boarded and put into my collection.
No, no. But if you found it for a dime,
yeah. Oh no, it's fine. You know, none of this is obviously for the show.